Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. This is a jam-packed podcast episode for you. Make sure you lift with your knees, not with your back. So much going on. We'll be opening up with Chris Newmarker, the one and only from Mass Device, with his Newmarker's Newsmakers. Then Kayleen Brown, our fantastic managing editor, will speak with Kevin Dempsey. He's senior director of business development at TCAN. TCAN is a proud sponsor of Device Talks, not only this here podcast episode, but we're very happy to have them support us at Device Talks Boston. And of course, they'll be doing a Device Talks Tuesdays as well. So Kayleen and Kevin talked a lot about neuromodulation, where it's headed, what are the changes that TCAN is seeing. So you'll get to learn a lot from that conversation following the Newmarker's Newsmakers. And then wrapping this all up, I get to talk with Megan Scanlon, Senior Vice President and President of Urology at Boston Scientific. Megan returns to Device Talks Weekly. Great to have her here. We'll talk about the Axonics acquisition, but we'll also talk about how urology is different from other medtech sectors and what special qualities it really requires from folks in the medical device industry, but also physicians. Great conversation, as always, with Megan. I really enjoy getting the opportunity to speak with her. So I hope you'll enjoy all of that. Before I let you get into it, though, I want to invite you to be part of Device Talks Boston. That's happening on April 30th and May 1st. Go to boston.devicetalks.com to register. And we'll have a great 2 days of keynotes and panel discussions. We'll have Yvonne Tornos from Zimmer Biomet. We'll have Cecilia Soriano from Baxter and many, many more fantastic speakers. So go to boston.devicetalks.com. You can find the agenda there. You can find our preliminary list of speakers there. We have a lot more speakers being identified, and we'll be putting them up there. So, but it's going to be fantastic. And we would also very much love to see you at Device Talks Minnesota, which is back on June 11th at the McNamara Alumni Center. This is a one-day affair, June 11th, as I said. Go to minnesota.devicetalks.com to register for that. That is going to be a special kind of boutique conference for Device Talks. Really going to focus on some of the major technologies and markets in the medtech space. Great keynotes, including Duke Rolin of Ajax. And we have Brooke Story from Becton Dickinson, who's going to be giving a great, great keynote conversation at the end, speaking from her medtech experience and her also her life experience. And it's going to be, I think, a really fantastic way to end the day-long discussion. So go to minnesota.devicetalks.com to register for that. We'll have a lot more up on that website very shortly, but I promise you it's going to be a fantastic couple of days. If you're registering for Device Talks Boston, the early bird rate is running out. It'll be running out right at near the end of the month. So save yourself some money. Register now, and we definitely want to see you there. Finally, go to devicetalks.com to check out our upcoming lineup of Device Talks Tuesdays. Our season is sold out, so all of our sponsor-led sessions are taken, but we'll get some great other events coming your way, including a surgical robotics series in April that we'll put up for registration fairly soon. So much going on. I'm winded. I think I'm going to take a break and let you listen to the rest of this podcast. Thanks again to TCAN for sponsoring, and thank you, all of you, for being here and being part of this podcast. Let's go. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Newmarker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom, doing well.
Going on at that house of yours, Chris Newmarker?
Oh man, yeah.
Run amok.
Right. We're talking on Friday, Valentine's Day, and the schools for the Wayzata School District are closed as they do parent teacher conferences. We did our own marathon yesterday evening, so it's busy around the Newmarker house for sure.
Did your daughter get the TV, the show that she's looking for now?
I think so. I think it's getting figured out. So it's a good deal.
She has no appreciation for how important and powerful this podcast is. Obviously,
you know, I was like, Daddy's got to record a podcast right now. So you know,
I know, and she didn't like say, gasp, forgive me, Father.
Forgive me.
she stuck to her guns and said, change the channel, Dad.
That's right.
Tell the goofy guy on the TV screen to go away.
I'm raising type A leaders around this house, Tom. Exactly. That's right. Kind of looking forward to that retirement when, you know, me and my wife, Kelly, we can go, you know, we can just go visit the kids at their islands that they own and stuff. It'll be great.
There you go. All right. Well, we've got a short window to record this, so let's just roll into our new market.
We're just going to roll it. We're going to do this. Like, roll the drums. Off we go. No need to talk about that weird Super Bowl. Like, let's just go. Let's just do this. So
there's nothing really much to
Who
say
cares?
There. It was a butt kicking, and we're moving on. Go Patriots.
I did. Yeah, go.
Still the best team ever. But anyway, go ahead. Yeah, no, it's fine.
I'm very partial to them. Like Vikings take a lot of emotional. You got to be careful not to get too emotionally attached. They'll break your heart. Number five on the list. This got some attention around the Twin Cities here. You know, Inspire Medical, which is this like up and coming company growing a lot with this implantable, neuromod tech to treat sleep apnea. They disclosed in their earnings this week that they are responding to a DOJ, civil investigation. Asking them to turn over some information. Related to some kind of allegations around false claims. From violations of the anti-kickback statute. When this came out around their earnings. The stock went down, but it's since recovered. So it seems that investors are taking this in stride. And other than that, my gosh, bottom line up 24.5% in the fourth quarter. Sales continue to like really grow over there. And I thought it was interesting in the earnings call. Fourth quarter revenue up 25%. I mean, that's great, and I thought it was interesting in the earnings call that CEO Tim Herbert was asked about, GLP-1s, and, he kind of had an argument kind of similar to what, McFarrell at ResMed, which makes CPAPs, was saying like he thought in the long run this was going to, be good, that, like people lose enough weight, the more people will qualify for this implantable Inspire therapy to treat their sleep apnea. So, we'll see how that plays out.
I think we're all going to be looking back at the GLP-1 stuff 10 years from now and saying either we completely underestimated what it was or we completely overestimated the impact. I'm kind of leaning toward overestimated what the long-term impact will be. I don't know. I think people getting off it after a period of time. I don't know if it's the magic bullet that everyone is hoping it will be. And I want it to be. I want it to be a magic bullet. I'm not rooting against it,
right.
But we'll see. I'll bet on, I think as we said in a previous podcast, I'll bet long-term on MedTech. We said this with Rachel Robinson last week.
I saw a headline, and I'm an Axios subscriber. I'm a fan of Axios. I like how they can just like hit you with these nice newsletter emails with general news and kind of like what we do.
Yeah.
But I liked how I got something from them in my inbox about it was basically saying it's the luster wearing off on GLP-1s. Hmm. And they're kind of sound like health physicians are getting getting a little more realistic about them.
Yeah, and maybe if the formularies change or the formulation is changed and it's pills instead of injections and it's something that's more of a daily dose than as opposed to a weekly or monthly shot. Maybe that gets.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to improve the drug, so there's obviously the opportunity for that as well. So I guess at the end of the day, totally. We don't know. But
we don't know.
We have joked when you brought this one as number five. I saw DOJ and I'm wondering, like, do we still have a Department of Justice? I mean, what is this? I wonder what kind of investigations we'll be seeing in the future. And I'm not trying to be political.
That's true.
I'm being honest. I'm like, I don't know. Like, I just don't know. And I'm sure someone will let us know that there's a whole new division that hasn't been touched. But it's interesting times for sure.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. And we just keep on doing the good work and, stand up for what's right when we have to.
All right, let's roll on to number four, Chris Neumarker. What you got?
Hey, number four on the list, another MedTech IPO, Woo, IPOs are back. I mean, I think we can say that now,
right? They filed for an IPO.
They filed for an IPO.
Have a drink of water there. Hold on. They filed for an IPO.
Yes,
sir. We're talking, of course,
get my mugger.
About Kestra Medical.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Kestra Medical, based in Kirkland, Washington. Maker of a wearable cardioverter defibrillator, they've filed an intent to go public with an IPO, and associate editor Sean Hooley, who is so important to all the content we get out on Mass Device. He wrote this article, and he did the smart thing and didn't see the amount of the listing in the main body, but when he went down to a filing fee schedule, it was saying roughly $100 million at this point, and we'll see what happens if this plays out. It could be more. I mean, Beta Bionics last month, I mean, it ended up being $204 million. Mm-hmm. So we've had a whole series of these. So it's overall, I mean, this seems to be really good news for the industry and good news for younger companies. It looks like we've got this option opening up again that, you don't necessarily have to be acquired to have an exit.
Yep, that is certainly good news. And as we've seen, the IPOs can also convince some strategics to buy companies before they file to go public. Maybe we'll even see someone stepping in and buy Kestra Medical now that they filed and sort of pursued another option. So it always always loosens things up. So we'll hopefully
it's kind of like renting that triangle outside the ranch house at the end of the day, Come on.
Well, I was going to say something about a pot, but we won't use the get off the pot metaphor. But yes, so hopefully we'll see some more exit opportunities for MedTech.
Stick with my ranch metaphor. I mean, I was picturing nice steaks on a picnic table. I mean, all good stuff.
Sound more appealing. You're right.
Pass the homemade bread.
All right, Chris Neumarker, what is number three on your vaunted award-winning Neumarker's Newsmakers list?
I mean, number three is on your neck of the woods. I mean, we picked up on the Mass Device. Sean picked up on local media reports in Boston about Mass General planning hundreds of layoffs amid a budget shortfall, and I mean, and just for people who aren't in that area of the country, you look at rankings of hospital systems around the country. I mean, the two main hospitals in the Mass General system, I mean, are consistently ranked among the top in the country. Mm-hmm. They definitely played an extremely important role then in the MedTech hub, around Boston. I mean, these are places where a lot of the innovation is going on. So, tough news over there. I did some checking around the news around the Twin Cities, and we've had some cuts as well with the health providers around here. I mean, Mayo Clinic's even going through reorg down in Rochester. Mm-hmm. Saw a Rochester Post bulletin report that they were, cutting 25% of their communications department at Mayo, that there's some stuff going on there, but definitely hundreds of jobs, significant budget shortfall. I mean, that definitely sounds very serious.
Yeah. And from what I read, I think it was mainly going to be managers, not frontline physicians, but
okay.
But, they're already, I mean, it's already, they're my hospital system, and they're my primary care is part of that network. And
yeah,
one of those situations when you call on the phone, no one's picking up. Like, these healthcare systems, even the leading ones, seem just so strapped. So it's and never a good thing. And then on top of that, you see the proposed cuts to NIH funding, which, as you mentioned, a lot of research is being done up this way and across the country, but in Massachusetts particularly. And that's going to, that doesn't pay for healthcare, obviously, but that money that's currently coming from the federal funding is going to have to come from someplace else. So,
And, you know, the thing, too, is, like, a lot of the arguments behind it, I mean, okay, the wasteful spending people are like, why are you just throwing out money to, I mean, I don't know, why are we throwing out money to help people, Tom? I mean, I don't know, but, you know, that those research dollars, I mean, turn into, like, so much more investment, so many more companies and jobs, you know, because we've, I mean, this is one of the really cool things about our country is we're such this engine of research, including medical research. So, and then, I mean, when I've looked at charts of areas of the country that get the most, the biggest chunks of the NIH funding, I mean, Boston's right up there. So,
yep, absolutely. I
mean, yep. So definitely, definitely some challenges there. And, we need to, you know, the healthcare system, obviously things are not working right now with our health providers.
No. And, ironically, or coincidentally rather, just before I got on the phone with you, I was speaking with Brooke Story of BD, and she'll be a keynote speaker at Device Talks Minnesota, talking about
fantastic
her harrowing experience with the healthcare system. With her twin sister had a stroke, and Brooke's her primary caregiver, and the story she tells of trying to navigate the system, even with the connections she had and the knowledge she had, how difficult it is. It's terrifying.
One of our other close contacts on LinkedIn, you know, who works a lot with us, was like posting a thing on LinkedIn about, you know, living in Italy and his wife had a medical emergency at home.
Steve Bell, yep.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, over there, I mean, yeah, he pays a lot more taxes in Italy, but I mean, it got taken care of smoothly and, you know, no bills, no, like, wow, you know, right?
Well, it was interesting to read. I won't argue for what they've got over there, but thank God Steve's wife, is doing well, and Brooke Story's sister is recovering, and we'll hear a story about that experience at Device Talks Minnesota. She'll be our closing keynote, and I think it'll add a poignant period to the end of the day for folks who make their lives, spend their lives making medical devices to help people get better care. It's an important message.
Totally. Yeah. All right. Well, we better hurry up and finish this up here. We got number two on the list. Medtronic is acquiring a nanotech for a NAT from Nanovus. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's for interbody fusion systems. And this got, you know, I think anytime Medtronic just hasn't been making a lot of acquisitions, so anytime we hear that they're acquiring something, you know, it gets a lot of attention for Mass Device readers. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because, you know, we were writing about Stryker spinning off their spine business, and, you know, I mean, Zimmer Biomet spun off theirs. Like, gosh, how many years ago has that been now? Or, you know, but, you know, like, Medtronic spine is, like, a really, really successful part of the company, especially with those Mazor robots. So, yeah, they're acquiring to boost it even more, so.
Yep. Interesting timing. And speaking of spinoffs, Chris Neumarker, let's roll on to number one.
Number one on the list is, you know, reports that J&J wants to sell Cerenovus for $1 billion. That was according to anonymous sources in the Financial Times. You know, J&J, you know, told, this was actually from managing editor Jim Hamrahan. This is Jim's story, but they told Jim in a statement they don't comment on market rumors or speculation, you know, but, you know, you see these leaks happen sometimes, you know, when stuff's being considered. So yeah, this would be another spinoff. I know on LinkedIn you were commenting that you thought this was interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, I you know, we're hearing obviously that, this is an area of investment and of growth for certain players in the space. And I thought J&J, you know, would invest rather than divest. But a lot of the comments I got basically supported the move and said that J&J really needs to focus on areas where it's strongest, and this is not an area where it's strongest. And the consensus of the people commenting on my post on LinkedIn seemed to be that it made sense. So
I love the time to get off the train.
Yeah,
you're going on the wrong track.
Saying now is if the train is in the wrong direction, get off the next stop. So
yeah, that's good advice, Joe. Someone who was writing the DC Metro when I was starting out in journalism. That's a good advice, you know. So.
All right, Chris Newmarker, great newsmaker lists.
Good as always, Tom.
And we'll look forward to recapping next week in a week. Take care, bud.
Awesome, Tom. Take care, man. Bye.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris Newmarker, for your award-winning. No, we've never really won an award. Newmarker's newsmakers. And now it's time to bring in Kayleen Brown's conversation with Kevin Dempsey. Kevin, once again, is Senior Director of Business Development at TCAN.
Kevin Dempsey, Senior Director of Business Development with TCAN Technology Development. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Hey, Kayleen. Great to be back talking to you again. I know we've done a few things together. It's always a pleasure. So thanks for having me back. I'm looking forward to it.
Kevin, for those who don't know about TCAN, can you share a bit about TCAN? And in particular, what is your mission?
It's quite a grand mission, actually. We say our mission is to improve people's lives and health by scaling innovation globally. So whether it's developing high precision devices for neurostimulation, for example, or optimizing energy delivery systems, or designing holistic solutions for complex challenges, we can partner with our customers to help them drive these meaningful advancements in healthcare.
Kevin, in this interview, we actually talk about the fast-growing neurostimulation market. From your experience, what are the technology hurdles faced in the early R&D stages, and how does TCAN help their partners overcome these particular obstacles?
It's a big question. I'll break it up into a few bite-sized pieces, Kayleen, maybe. So it's a really cool application of technology in the med tech space. It's basically a body hack using energy to affect a clinical outcome. Now, the challenges from a device design point of view, one big one is material selection, in particular around biocompatibility. So selecting materials that are not only biocompatible, but also long-lasting under the extreme conditions of implantation in the body is a significant challenge. Advanced polymer coatings, fatigue-resistant metals, materials optimized for electrical and mechanical performance are essential. I suppose TCAN's expertise in material science helps our partners to evaluate and to prototype and test innovative materials to make sure that they're going to be compliant, they're going to meet the regulatory standards, and they're also going to deliver the clinical outcome that's looked for. So that's the first thing. The second, we're talking a lot of the time about implantable devices, so miniaturization. And of course, this is an energy delivery technology, so power management is very important. So developing ultra compact devices that integrate multiple functions, like for example stimulation, sensing, communication, that requires advanced design techniques where you're balancing the miniaturization with efficient power consumption. That's critical, especially for applications where extending battery life can reduce the need for frequent surgical replacements. So at TCAN, we would enable our customers to leverage state-of-the-art microfabrication techniques, for example, designed for manufacturing processes to meet the stringent demands without compromising the performance in the patient, which is what it's all about. And I suppose bringing that all together, you know, precision in the stimulation and the sensing of where you're going to be delivering the therapy is important. So high resolution targeting of neural tissues is vital to achieve the right therapeutic efficacy and safety. And this can require precision of your control of the stimulation parameters. You really need to have sophisticated sensing in a low noise environment, and that's an area that we have a lot of expertise in, as well as robust data processing algorithms. So at TCAN, we support the client by optimizing signals and incorporating real-time feedback mechanisms to enhance the device performance and ultimately the clinical outcome.
Let's shift slightly and talk about the space itself. So we know it's a competitive field, and we know that speed to market is absolutely critical. So what strategies does your team employ to accelerate development without compromising the quality and the safety? As you mentioned earlier, that is absolutely key.
So there's a lot of excitement, I think, in a lot of industries about the concept of a digital twin. So using digital tools to short loop and de-risk the physical activities, which we all know are time-consuming and expensive. So we have industry-leading experts using the most advanced physics simulation tools to simulate device performance under a large variety of complex conditions in the body. And that allows for early detection and mitigation of potential issues. And so that's a very important part of our approach. Another part of our approach is design by prototype. So we focus on getting hardware very early in the project. That allows us to de-risk any key technological challenges as early as possible in the program. And in terms of our prototyping, it's very agile. Our rapid prototyping capabilities would enable quick iteration and refinement, facilitating a very prompt feedback loop and a short adjustment cycle to really dial in a solution. So a big enabler in our rapid prototyping is our highly flexible, very well-established embedded control platform. And that's something that we use in a lot of our technology, and there's a lot of background IP associated with that, but that is licensed to our customers for free for the lifetime of their device. And it really enables us to short loop and get to physical prototypes early that we can test. And then the exchange between the simulation and the experimental outcomes with the prototypes dramatically accelerates the development. And Kayleen, so that's in a nutshell how we do it. But the last piece of our magic sauce, we talked about this at Device Talk Boston last year at our panel, and I know we've spoken on a webinar with you about it. It's our parallel design pathway. So this is an approach we developed to allow us to succeed in our fixed cost commercial model. So when we give a bid to our clients to do the most complex technology development, it's fixed cost. So we have we take all the financial risk there. So we always apply a parallel design pathway. So if one of the solutions that we are exploring hits a brick wall, we can always back up to the next viable solution and carry on the journey as quickly as possible to assure that we do deliver world-class solutions in the time frame and at the cost we said we would do it for our customers.
We know collaboration is key now more than ever. The future, let's talk about that a little bit. So are you seeing any exciting trends or advancements in the field like neurostim?
You know, neurostimulation, it's been around for a while, and I think people have learned of some of the limitations of earlier systems, and these limitations are certainly being addressed in more modern systems. For example, closed loop systems and wireless technology. So closed looped neurostimulation systems dramatically can dynamically adjust stimulation based on real-time feedback from the body. And they're revolutionizing patient care by improving the efficacy and minimizing side effects. So not giving more energy than is needed. Along with miniaturization and the integration of wireless technology, systems are becoming increasingly sophisticated, which enables more precise and personalized treatments. At TCAN, we work in miniaturizing electronic components and optimizing energy transfer solutions, and that lends itself very well to the development of smaller, more effective implantable devices that are more comfortable for the patient. So closed loop systems and wireless technology for external communication is big. And then, you know, traditionally, electricity was the main player in neurostimulation, but we're starting to see some literature now about alternate technologies. So, you know, although electrical stimulation has been the cornerstone in the industry to date, there are growing interest in alternate technologies such as optical stimulation or ultrasound based neuromodulation. And these techniques have the potential to offer non-invasive, highly targeted stimulation, which have fewer side effects. So in TCAN, we're exploring how to integrate novel modalities into existing platforms, providing our clients and partners with flexibility to develop next generation devices that leverage cutting edge technology. So I suppose wrapping that all up, the next generation of neurostimulation devices will most likely continue that trend of miniaturization, focusing on even more specific nerve targeting, such as wrapping directly around the nerves of interest to increase the precision of the treatment. Implants with longer battery life and wireless power solutions are going to become more prevalent because that reduces the need for more frequent surgical interventions. And at TECAN, our research into power efficient design and energy harvesting methods really positions our clients and partners to stay ahead of the trends. And that ensures future devices not only perform better, but are also going to meet the evolving needs of the patients.
You know, Kevin, every time I have the opportunity to sit down with you, I learn so much. I'm particularly intrigued by the stepping away from sort of the electrical idea and moving to alternative methods. Is just on a personal asking, is there a place we could go or something we could watch or read to tell us more about maybe where the direction of this space is going?
A specific resource is difficult. I mean, you pick it up by going to great shows like Device Talk Boston, talking to innovators and disruptors who are trying to overcome the limitations of the technology that's already available. And these really smart people realize that neurotechnology, as I said earlier, it's a body hack. It's the ability to deliver energy to get a clinical outcome. But that's not the only way to hack the body. So people are starting to use some really cool wearables, for example, that can that might use temperature, for example, to reset the nervous system to mitigate symptoms of certain conditions. I know of one great example in the menopause space where a simple wearable can give lots and lots of relief to sufferers, particularly of hot flushes and things like that. So that's one example. But then, you know, if you have to go inside and hit the nerves, why can't you use other techniques that can get through the outer human barrier, like light, for example, like ultrasound can get in, etc. So yeah, the future is bright, and there's a lot of innovators and smart people out there that are trying to develop these body hacks and really reduce suffering for people of a large multitude of conditions.
Fortunately, I have to wrap us up, Kevin. What is your perspective on the importance of partnerships in medtech, especially when developing devices that push technological boundaries?
Yeah, I think, yes, it's a great question, and we always have fun with this one. Thanks for asking it. So, you know, I always tend to look at things at different levels and in different ways, but I think at a company-to-company level, you know, partnerships are the backbone of innovation, especially when you're developing medical devices that push technological boundaries. So by collaborating with industry leaders and clinical experts, etc., early stage or world-class companies can stay ahead of emerging trends. They have access to cutting-edge technologies and capabilities, and they can identify very quickly unmet clinical needs earlier in the development process. So companies working with other companies who have a different view of the world or a different set of experiences can really bring a lot to the innovation cycle. At a functional level, developing breakthrough technologies requires, as we've talked about before, integrating insights from multiple disciplines, such as material science, biomedical engineering, software development, and regulatory, etc. So partnerships foster cross-disciplinary collaboration, and that accelerates the problem solving, and it really enables innovative approaches that wouldn't emerge in a silo. We are not fans of silos at TECAN Technology Development Group at all. And you know, another big part of it for a lot of our customers and a lot of the great innovators in our space don't have the resources and infrastructure that some of the bigger OEMs and more strategic players have. So by partnering with companies like TECAN, you're accessing resources and infrastructure that you wouldn't otherwise have been able to get access to. So this collaborative approach can reduce costs, shorten development timelines, and really ensures that even the smaller innovators can leverage world-class capabilities. So partnerships, partnerships, partnerships. And even, you know, as you know very well, Kaylin, it's an ecosystem, and Device Talks Boston is very critical in bringing, you're like a catalyst, you bring the different parts of the equation together and create environments where we can network and meet each other and share ideas and collaborate. And I know the events are great for making those relationships, and it really is playing a very important role in the whole medtech innovation cycle. So thank you for that, and I very much look forward to continuing the discussions on partnership and how we can continue to make that better.
Well, thank you for your kind words. I didn't even pay you to say that. That is just straight from you.
Not
thank
needed.
You so much, Kevin.
Not needed. So,
I hate to end our time together. Again, it is my greatest pleasure to sit down with you and learn so much about what you do and how you partner with the medical device industry. So Kevin Dempsey, Senior Director of Business Development with TCAN Technology Development, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure as always. Take care, Kaylin.
And to learn more about partnering with TCAN Technology Development, please, please, please visit partnering.tcan.com. That's partnering.tcan, T-E-C-A-N.com.
All right. Well, thank you to Kaylin Brown and Kevin Dempsey for that conversation. Once again, you can find TCAN, the fine folks at TCAN, at Device Talks Boston. They'll have a session. They'll be on the floor. They always add so much to the show, and we're grateful to have them as part of Device Talks. Now I get to speak to one of my favorite people, Megan Scanlon. Again, she is Senior Vice President and President of the Urology Group at Boston Scientific. Megan Scanlon, welcome back to the podcast.
Tom, thank you for having me back. It's good to see you again.
You're always a fan favorite, so I was happy when your folks reached out and said, do you want to talk to Megan? I was like, heck yes. And a lot going on, too. We'll talk about the Axonics acquisition in a moment. But we've had you on the podcast before. We went through your whole how you got into medtech story, and folks can find, I'll post the link to that past episode, but just to bring folks up to speed a little bit, you became an engineer, and your first job in industry was actually at Gillette.
That's
right. I want to talk about the transfer to MedTech. What was that like, and how can you at all compare working in the two, not very different industries, but different industries?
So the transition to MedTech went as follows. I had been working on the very early stages of what ultimately became the Venus Razor.
Okay.
And, you know, having come from very deep technical roles where you're looking at, like, you know, injection molding cycles and dimensioning and tolerancing of certain components, to now being able to pull back to a wider aperture and look at what was the market opportunity we were going after and starting to work with some of the marketing and business folks, it just kind of blew the horse blinders off my face. And that was the catalyst for me to develop an interest in going to get my MBA.
Interesting.
So, you know, I pivoted, I ended up leaving Gillette and went to get my MBA and my master's of engineering full time over 2 years. And that was the springboard that really pivoted me into med tech. Interestingly, this was in the year 2000, and most people were going into fillintheblank.com.
Right.
Right.
Right. We covered that before.
Yep. Yeah. There's something about healthcare that just drew me. Mm-hmm. But the magic unlock was MedTech and the surgical procedures they do. It's stuff that you can touch and feel, right? They're mechanical solutions to biomechanical problems. And so it just really scratched the engineering itch in my brain. But also allowed me to take a bigger picture view on the kinds of innovations that could really advance patient care, advance efficiency in the OR, and not just for physicians, but also for nurses and staff. So it was just the perfect marriage of, like, business and engineering. And that's versus on the technical side, working at Gillette was incredibly fun. I absolutely loved it. I love high volume manufacturing. But as a lower level engineer, right, you're working on you know, small things at very deep levels. And I now get to look more broadly across a whole global market opportunity of the specialty of urology.
That's a great way to put all that. I love the metaphor of the blinders being blown off. Is that something that is in every engineer? I mean, are some engineers their happy place is not, and I don't want to put the blinders on as a negative, but they want to focus on the stuff. They want to focus on the building things. Or do you think a lot of engineers would like that broader view and like to have the blinders knocked
off? There's a full continuum, right?
Yeah.
And look, thankfully there are people whose happy place is deep in the details and analytics, and that's where they want to stay, right? That's their superpower. We do see time and time again, and actually some of our best marketers and business leaders actually got their start in engineering as well. So part of it is when you pull engineers into voice of customer sessions, or you bring them into the lab where they're working side by side with clinicians and nurses, you do sometimes see that spark start to fire. But there's no, as with anything, there's no generalization for how all engineers think. Thankfully, there's a beautiful and wide variety of skills and motivations and places where people find their passion.
Absolutely.
If everybody wanted to go, you know, be the next big business leader, it'd be really hard to get projects out the door.
Absolutely. Do you, as a mentor, do you try to encourage people to sort of look around and just to see if they like the view, or do you let them find their own way? Like, do you encourage them?
A little bit
them
of both. I think a little bit of both. We, and this is actually embedded in the culture at Boston Scientific, we really encourage people to take stretch assignments if they think they might be interested in another function or another experience. And so that allows them to dip their toe in the water, but also forge connections and experiences. So I'd say, you know, I've been at BSC for 10 years now. We see a ton of movement of our engineering talent coming into marketing all the time. Heck, some have even gone out into sales because they love being in the operating room supporting physicians and their staff to accomplish great things. So sometimes you can sort of see it in somebody that they could be potentially wired to tackle different kinds of jobs and functions. And those are always fun conversations to kind of dive and swim in the what ifs for a little while.
Absolutely. Oh, that's great. I love the idea of a stretch assignment, because you can go through your career very quickly doing the same thing for a number of years, and then you look up and you wish you'd tried something else, because people want to sometimes keep you in that same role. So that's a great policy. Well, thank you for that. Let's talk about urology, the urology market, and then we'll get into your portfolio. I was just listening to the podcast of the panel discussion that you led at Device Talks Boston a couple of years ago, which was a great overview of LithoVue and sort of how it found its way into the market. And I was just struck by when you talked about doctors guessing, and guessing is a terrible word to use, but talking about measuring or estimating what is intraurinary pressure? Is that what I'm...
Intrarenal pressure,
thank you. How it was just still kind of a Wild West sort of situation, and you're able to bring some tech to that. Where is urology in... Talk a bit about the urology market. I'd love to know where it is in terms of the adoption of new technologies. And this is a three-part question, obviously. What are the physicians like? Are they open to new technologies? Are they fast adopters?
Well, actually, so let me start with your second question first. And it's
Absolutely.
Part of what makes urology fun. Of all the specialties I've served, right? So I've worked in orthopedic sports medicine, GI endoscopy, and now urology. And I've enjoyed each of those markets and those customer sets for very different reasons. There's something really special about urologists, and they really are, first of all, they tend to be very good natured. And I think part of it is the nature of the clinical work they have to perform and the sort of sensitivity of the anatomical areas that they have to serve patients. You have to have a good bedside manner
and
put people at ease, right?
Yeah.
But they are very much a specialty that is hungry for innovation. Some of it, I think, is just the nature of urologists, but also some of it is the nature of this orchard of unmet needs and innovation opportunities to make procedures safer, faster, more predictable, improve outcomes, right? We have not tapped out on the innovation scale for urology. And so what's fun is, I'd say, the pace of innovation coming into urology, whether it's in BPH, whether it's in kidney stone therapy, whether it's in prostate cancer, or incontinence, erectile dysfunction. There's innovation coming from every corner of the world, companies big and small, and that actually creates a really, I think, fertile environment to excite and induce investment, mm-hmm. and to really attract talent into the specialty.
Has it been an area that has received a lot of attention and investment in the past?
So historically, not a ton. Mm. I'd say it's really been awoken. Is that a word?
We'll use it.
Yep, it is now. I think it's really been awoken in probably the last decade. I mean, look, mm-hmm. there's always been investment in urology, and BSC has a track record of innovation investments in urology. Or in the early days, it was really predominantly in kidney stones. But I'd say, like, venture capital investments, startup companies, the pace of that innovation, through my perspective, seems to have really taken a pretty fun step up. I mean, look at the acquisition journey of just Boston Scientific Urology. We've made 5 acquisitions in the last, 6 or 7 years?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of this investment, right, pays off in these acquisition opportunities as well.
So I think you expressed the hunger for physicians for innovation, and I can't think of especially where patients are as hungry for better ways as well.
Yeah, Tom, that's one of the things that I think becomes most motivating when you work mm-hmm. in urology. Look, it's obviously very motivating if you can bring innovations to help people live with healthier hearts,
mm-hmm.
right? The heart is sort of at the core of what keeps you alive. However, when you think about the magnitude of the life impact of some of these more, through the lens of the patient, what they see to be more shameful conditions, private conditions, conditions they're embarrassed about that cause them to actually retract themselves from, like, the joy of daily living, the joy of relationships. You know, you talk to patients who have stopped going to sporting events because their incontinence has become so severe,
mm-hmm.
and they don't want to be the person in the stands who's wearing a diaper
mm-hmm.
Because they're worried about leaking. You talk to men who have been suffering from severe ED for a long time who have started to distance themselves from their partner,
mm-hmm.
and it has, you know, or might stop working out because it's sort of like, well, what's the point, right? And
right.
And the impact that has on health, confidence, work productivity, it's really, really, really meaningful. And then when you talk to these patients after we've helped solve their incontinence, after we've helped solve their ED, it's night and day.
Mm-hmm.
And just this past, it's been really in the past year and a half, we've been trying to destigmatize these conditions through 2 different campaigns. One, which is really trying to reach men who are suffering from severe erectile dysfunction with a campaign called HARD. And yes, you know, that gets a little bit of a chuckle from people, mm-hmm. but it's meant to be a bit of a double entendre because it's really about how brutally difficult that journey is and how hard your life becomes when you aren't operating as a full, you know, to the extent in your full self.
Sure.
And then we've taken that humanization of those stories and we've now applied it to a new campaign called DRY, which is really looking to, initially it's really reaching, targeted towards men who are suffering from severe stress urinary incontinence, oftentimes post-radical prostatectomy. And the power of these videos, when they're played, for instance, in a physician's office with a patient who isn't sure what to do, and they can see these journeys of how these men's lives have been transformed. It's pretty neat. And it gets us excited about Axonics because Axonics has done a lot of great work reaching out to men and women and patients of all genders suffering from incontinence. So forget innovations for a second in product form. There's also innovation in the way we educate, inspire, and activate patients to choose to do something different.
That's amazing. And that is inspiring. And you're right. There's can't think of anything more solitary of a condition. If you have a heart problem, you're obviously concerned, or a lung problem, you're concerned. But there are communities out there. You immediately plug into, I'm now a member of this community. There isn't that for a lot of the things that you're fixing. Yeah. Amazing. Okay. Well, let's just walk quickly through the highlights of your current portfolio, because it's extensive. But how would you let's define your sort of current portfolio, maybe in two or three or whatever number of categories you want to use.
So kidney stone, mm-hmm. Flexible ureteroscopy, kidney stones is a substantive part of our portfolio. Then we have prostate health, which helps devices to help treat benign prosthetic hyperplasia, as well as one product category that helps patients who are undergoing radiation therapy for prostate cancer, helps to protect the rectum from the radiation dose as they're going through that treatment regimen. Then we have prosthetic urology. Prosthetic urology is the category of implants to help patients suffering from ED and male stress urinary incontinence. And then we have OAB and the broader incontinence category, which helps patients of all genders who are suffering from OAB, from stress urinary incontinence, and from fecal incontinence now with the Axonix portfolio that's joined us 4 weeks ago.
Okay. So all of those verticals, the technologies that are required for those devices, you've got your scopes, you've got visualization, you've got digital, but you haven't had a neurostim product in your portfolio yet, have you?
Urology portfolio.
Not in the urology, right. The urology portfolio.
That's right.
So let's start talking about Axonix. The company was going gangbusters, so it's not hard to understand why you're interested. But talk first about the movement, the inclusion of a neurostim product into a portfolio that doesn't have a neurostim product. Is it much different? Is it just another tool in the toolbox? How does it fit into your portfolio?
Well, so let me first start. I mean, when we look at things, we always look first at sort of the patient need and the opportunity for, reaching more patients around the world. So it's not we were interested in neurostim. It was more we're very interested in understanding, patients who are suffering from incontinence broadly and ways in which we could improve their lives. And so neurostim plays a really important role in that. And candidly, it's a skill set broadly held at Boston Scientific, right, across some of our different categories. So we have had our eyes on the Axonix business and the Axonix team since its inception, right? Their first product launch was in 2019. First rechargeable, active implantable device to help patients with OAB. That was, the neat thing about rechargeable is it's really small. Now they're already on their fourth generation. You charge it a couple times a year, and it really helps to alleviate your OAB symptoms.
Talk about OAB, just to make sure we're all...
OAB stands for overactive bladder.
Oh, okay.
And it's basically when your brain and your bladder are not having the conversations they should have, and these active implantable devices help, in essence, restore some of that connection, to oversimplify it.
How does the, and maybe if this isn't a good time to do it, let's put it off till later, but how does the device help? Does it contract the bladder until
it stimulates the sacral nerve.
Okay.
So the sacral nerve, basically is one of the neurological structures that helps to kind of activate and control the bladder. And so that stimulating the sacral nerve sort of helps to restore your bladder to more normal functional performance.
Okay, cool, great. All right, continue with your story, I'm sorry.
Okay. Oh, so we've had our eye on the Axonix team for quite some time. If you look at the OAB market, the size of that market, the potential number of patients who need care, in the US alone, it's something like 30 million patients over the age of 40 suffer from overactive bladder.
Wow. Right?
So it's a really big market opportunity. It's wildly, wildly underpenetrated. And there had previously only been one company in this category until Axonix entered the marketplace. So you know, we've been tracking them very closely. They've done a wonderful job of diversifying their portfolio. They started with the rechargeable implant, mm-hmm. which basically means, right, you, if you're a patient, the you get the implant and then a couple times a year, you have to externally charge the device. They then expanded their product portfolio to a primary cell implant, which I always describe it as set it and forget it, right? It's kind of like a pacemaker, right? You mm-hmm. you implant it, you don't have to recharge it. And the battery life that they're getting out of that primary cell device now is something like 15 plus years of battery life for the Axonix F15, which is their primary cell device. Mm-hmm. Then they expanded their product offering with an acquisition of a technology called Bulkamid, which is a bulking agent used to sort of bulk up the pelvic floor in women mm-hmm. suffering from stress urinary incontinence. You know, nice minimally invasive procedure that helped them to kind of expand broader on the incontinence care continuum. So stress urinary incontinence and overactive bladder sort of fall under the broader incontinence umbrella.
Is the bulking material used with the device? Does it make more people... more people can benefit from the neuro device with the use of the bulking matter as well, or are they
actually,
two separate?
For the most part, I would think of them somewhat differently, right? So stress urinary incontinence typically comes from a weakening of the pelvic floor, right? You know, women carrying babies, delivering babies, that can put a lot of stress on the pelvic floor. So what you're trying to do is really strengthen and stabilize the pelvic floor. So the urethra has something to push against and you don't have urine leakage. Overactive bladder is more that neurological issue associated with the wiring of the bladder, so to speak. Now, I imagine there are some patients who are suffering from both, but they're treating different symptoms of the cause of their incontinence, if that makes sense. One is mechanical and one is like electrical.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you for that. So how... I'd like to understand more how Axonix is fitting into your portfolio. Is it another device product that goes in your sales bag of your current sales team? Is it a different market entirely? How does it fit into what Boston Scientific has been doing traditionally in urology?
Okay, so for sacral neuromodulation, because it's a very different market. Okay. You know, patients undergo what's called a trial, where the leads for the active implantable device are placed in a first procedure, and it allows you to apply stimulation to the sacral nerve before you've actually delivered the full implant. The patient can then sort of go for a couple of days to get a sense if they're getting the relief to determine if the leads are being put in the right location. And then mm-hmm. the patient can come back for their permanent implant. You know, you fine tune the way in which the stim is being delivered, and then the patient can kind of go off and live an improved life. There's a dedicated sales team in the United States. Most of what I'll talk about today, unless we explicitly talk about international opportunities, I'll talk about the framing in the U.S. There's a large and incredible dedicated selling organization that is servicing the sacral neuromodulation portfolio. That is staying standalone. It's like one of our other dedicated franchise selling orgs in like Stone, for instance. Mm-hmm. The Bulkamid team actually combined together with our pelvic floor team. Okay. So prior to Axonix, we have a small but important portfolio, which we called pelvic floor. And those were our slings for stress urinary incontinence. So now with bulking and with slings, you can offer a full continuum of solutions in this sort of shared decision-making model. So patients and physicians can talk about which device suits what they're trying to accomplish the most. For instance, if you think you still might want to have children, something like bulking might be a better solution. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if you're looking for more sort of definitive long-term outcomes and you're done having children, maybe a sling is the right solution. We want to have options so physicians and patients can have an intelligent conversation with one another and decide what's best. So we have now a team focused on, you know, pelvic floor with that combined bag
Okay, great.
Of bulking and slings.
And just circling back to the technology for a second, you mentioned the trial for the Exonix system. What does success look like? A patient who has the leads put in and walks out, and what is that patient experiencing?
So the purpose of the trial is you can provide that external stimulation through the leads that are down near the sacral nerve, and then the patient can go home for a couple days and really monitor their better bladder control. And if it's working, great, they come back in, they get the permanent procedure. And sometimes if it's not, they actually might just need to tweak the location of the leads a bit to see if they can get the kind of relief that they're seeking. But mm-hmm. that's why the trial, it's sort of like, you know, you do the test drive before you buy the car. Mm-hmm. That's the analogy I'll use for the trial.
That works. So we talked about how it's fitting into, how the product is fitting into your portfolio. How is Exonix the company fitting into Boston Scientific proper? How has the integration gone?
Yeah. Well, we're 4 weeks in. And so far,
you're not done yet. Come on.
Yeah, the 4 weeks are going really well. And what we're doing is we're really allowing that team with some legacy BSC leaders collaborating with them in Irvine. The business is located in Irvine, California, to continue to operate largely the way they had operated previously. They have a ton of momentum. There's still a lot we, as the legacy Boston Scientific team, need to learn. So together we can sort of chart our shared path forward to more complete integration. So this isn't a show up day one, you know, tell them all the 87 things we need to change, because we just don't know enough yet. So they know their business better than we do. And the talent in that organization is nothing short of outstanding. They've been super open, super patient as they answer our questions and educate us. We really like the combination of the two organizations. And even as our sales teams are connecting in cities across the world, getting to know one another, there's a lot of shared enthusiasm for what we can do to partner with hospitals and help treat more patients in the specialty of urology. Mm-hmm. 4 weeks in, we couldn't be happier.
That's great. You mentioned the acquisitions that have occurred in the past. So that means you've been involved with integration in the past. What are the secrets to a good corporate integration? Are there secrets? Are there singular lessons that you can apply, or universal lessons you can apply, or is every situation different?
Both. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've been really lucky to have either architected, participated in, or led over a dozen acquisitions in my career now, across all the different businesses that I've served. And lesson number one is, if you've seen one, you've seen one. Mm-hmm. and part of it is to recognize it requires a very bespoke approach, because cultures are different, technologies are different, market segments are different, the competitive landscape is different. Some cultures are very top-down in the nature in which decisions are made. Others mm-hmm. might be really collaborative. And so you can't just show up with this mindset of like assimilate or die, right? What I've really loved, if you look at how our urology business has been built, we've been able to take all of these cultural sort of pearls and gems and evolved who we are mm-hmm. in aggregate as a result of that. So lesson number one is, if you've seen one, you've seen one. And sort of first go in and like listen more than you instruct, right? Now, depending on what you're acquiring, if there are things that can stand alone for a little bit, sometimes letting it stabilize so they can kind of get to know your business and who you are and the culture of Boston Scientific, and you can start collaborating together. Sometimes that's absolutely the right path. And that's what we're doing with the S&M team in Exonix. And sometimes if there's channel overlap or portfolio adjacency or portfolio overlap, sometimes it makes sense to move quickly, mm-hmm. right? So you don't have sales teams fighting one another. I've made that mistake in the past. So it's knowing what you need to move fast on, knowing what you should take the time to learn, I think are really important. There's two other lessons I think are worth calling out for the acquiring company. Avoid what I call the hold my beer phenomena, which is, you know, like the big multinational company acquires the small company with this sort of condescending, like, oh, look at you. Isn't this super cute what you did? You know, here, hold my beer. I'm going to show you how it's really done.
Yeah.
That drives me nuts. But the converse warning is true, or the inverse warning, which is don't come in being super apologetic that you've just acquired this company, right? There's a strategic thesis. You will need to be intentional about that. You need to welcome them into your organization and be really transparent along the way. And there's going to be some things you have to do, like integrating IT systems. That's never fun, right? That's tough work. But there's a big why, because once you do that, then your ability to scale globally unlocks great potential. And the why is now we can reach more patients. So don't be too arrogant. Don't be too apologetic. And if you've seen one, you've seen one. Now, my next bit of it, my next learning is more, I think, the learnings for those who join the company as the acquired entity, which is don't assume you know that you're going to love it or you're going to hate it, right? I always say to everybody, give it a year. You're going to learn a ton regardless in that year, right? Going through integrations will always be a landmark moment in your resume. And some of you at the end of that year, and it's not a year explicitly, it's just directionally. Right. Some of you at the end of the year might be like, dang, this is a great company. I want to build a career here. I'm surrounded by people who have had 20, 25, 30, 35 years at Boston Scientific. Clearly they're doing something right. And then there might be others who are like, you know what? This was fun. I learned a ton. So glad I stuck it out. But I'm a small company gal. Or I'm a small company guy, or I'm a small company person, right? Like, and that's okay too. You don't have to hold it so precious. But change can be unnerving, right? And everybody, the unknown oftentimes gets filled with the most sort of salacious narratives. And we always just say, like, before you kind of fill the narrative yourself, just ask the question. So that's really the bit of advice that I always give to teams that join us through acquisition. Don't assume you know whether you're going to love it or hate it. Let's go on this journey together. So I'll stop there. I think that's those are some of the things I've taken away after, you know, a couple of decades of participating in these types of integrations and acquisitions.
No, that's great advice. And you're right about the mutual respect. I mean, the big company acquired the small company for a reason. You're doing something right. And the big company is a big company for a reason because they're doing something right. So you both have something to learn from each other.
And Tom, if I can...
Of course.
One of the things I love about just the medtech ecosystem, but I'll focus on urology. There really is, I think, this perfect yin and yang to the big multinationals and then the small startup companies, right? Because in the early days, the small startup companies, they're really agile and nimble, and they can kind of get after things with a speed that is sort of what startup companies are wired to do and maybe take different risks in the early days. But then there's a point where you get to a certain kind of growth scale that it's going to be harder for you to globalize and scale in the next wave of like your sales cycle and your market maturity cycle. And that's really, I think, when the large multinational companies can come in and help usher into the next phase of growth. Oftentimes that backdrop is globalization, right? And bringing into more international markets where the cost of scaling internationally is so complicated, where we already have that infrastructure and ecosystem. And, you know, when I look at, for instance, technologies like Rezūme, that Rezūme technology, which is for benign prosthetic hyperplasia, it's a steam technology, a vapor technology that's used to denature, you know, prostate adenoma cells that cause, urinary symptoms. That technology has been a darling of global growth. It would have been really hard for, you know, for NextThera, which was the company we acquired, to have achieved that kind of global scale.
Interesting. So where is urology headed as a specialty and as a business? What is it going to look like in 5 years or so?
Yeah, so the nice thing is I think for the specialty, there's a lot of continued innovation tackling unmet needs. If you look at the field of kidney stones, just the opportunity around driving better predictability, better efficiency, better safety, and maybe bringing some interconnected sort of like computer brain a la AI into how that ecosystem works is something we're really excited about. And we know other companies are as well. I think we're going to see a lot of advancements in the field of urologic oncology, which are adjacencies we're quite interested in exploring. And then honestly, maybe the third thing I'll say, I mean, I could go on, there's probably 15 things I could list, but the third thing I'd say is sort of technology aside, the single biggest innovation opportunity we have is how to reach more patients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the tens and tens and tens of millions of patients who are suffering from these conditions and the hundreds of thousands of them who get treated every year. Just the delta between those two alone is just a fertile playground, you know, to drive more growth. And so innovation in how we reach patients, educate patients, connect patients to physicians who are trained in mm-hmm. these new techniques, therapies, and skills is probably the thing I'm most excited about. And for us at Boston Scientific, so our business has such a huge component of it that comes from the U.S. market. The opportunity for us to continue to kind of grow and reach more markets internationally, that alone with the portfolio we have today, just remains an incredible runway of innovation and patient outreach.
That's a great point. And you'd mentioned the campaigns you'd undertaken already. But to your point about physicians, we were talking about urologists, but you're right. I think so much of these first experiences will go through the GPs and the primary cares. I think a lot of your success or the industry's success depends on that handoff to the urologist. So I don't know where you, like, I don't know what the chicken is. I don't know what the egg is. Do you educate the patients so they press the GPs to say, like, yeah, you're great, I love you, but like, get me to someone who can help more directly? Or is it reaching out to the GPs? It's probably going to be a little bit of everything.
Well, but it's a little bit of both, but I'll just share with you my personal perspective, right? Because the role of the GP has gotten incredibly challenging, right?
Absolutely.
They have to see a ton of patients in a day, try to get everything into their electronic medical records. And fundamentally, the things that the GP has to worry about, right, is like cardiovascular health, diabetes, and arthritis, or high blood pressure, right? So which cardiovascular disease, diabetes, blood pressure sort of sits in there. Trying to educate the GP about all of the other things that are happening sometimes can be like shouting into the wind,
mm-hmm.
right? So it doesn't mean you don't try. And obviously things like prostate cancer and you know, and some certain urological conditions, but very often GPs aren't asking patients, for instance, if they're suffering from erectile dysfunction, because that's not a quick conversation. They've maybe got 10 minutes with you, right? So we do think reaching the patient so they can then ask intelligent questions of their GP. You know, so if I have a dollar, maybe 90 cents of it goes into that and 10 cents goes into making sure then the GP has the resources they need to understand how to make the right handoff.
Interesting.
I just have an orchard of experiences where we tried to go all in on educating the GP and they have too much going on
right.
in their day, you know, to try to get super educated, for instance, about like, rotator cuff injuries, you mm-hmm. know, from my orthopedic days or BPH, right? They're tackling the big, big, big disease states that are at risk of killing people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes the more elective, quieter conditions that patients might have more shame, the patients also aren't always comfortable
mm-hmm.
bringing that up themselves. Sometimes it's easier if the question's asked, but if we can empower them with the right questions to ask, we see it moves the needle a little bit more meaningfully.
Well, I would imagine bring in a whole new slew of technologies, apps, other ways to reach patients and to get them involved. So, well, this has been a great conversation. I always learn a lot. The first time I talk to you, I've uptake my water. I've increased my water intake considerably after talking to you about
Smart
kidney stones
man.
The first time.
Nobody wants a kidney stone. Pain so, worse than natural childbirth is the way it's described.
I've heard that. So thank you for that help. And thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks, Tom. It was great to be back.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks weekly podcast. Thanks again to TCAN for sponsoring this episode. Thank you to Megan Scanlon for joining us. And thank you to you, our fantastic listeners, for giving us a reason to do a podcast. It's great to be able to talk to you and hopefully to meet you. We'd love to see you at Device Talks Boston. If you're kind of on the fence about it, get off the fence. Come out. It's really a great time. And you'll learn a lot. You'll make a lot of great connections. Just go to boston.devicetalks.com. You can check out the agenda. You can check out the speakers. And if you register before the end of the month, you'll save yourself some coin. That'll cover the hotel room. Problem solved. You got no reason not to come. Come to Device Talks Boston. Also, Device Talks Minnesota fans, we will be back in Minnesota on June 11th, as I said up at the top. We'll be at the McNamara Alumni Center. It's going to be a great day of MedTech conversations. I'm excited about the new Device Talks conference model that we're building, and I really want you to be part of that. Go to minnesota.devicetalks.com to register. We'll definitely be filling out that agenda shortly, filling out speakers. Thank you to everyone who has registered so far. I promise you it's going to be well worth your time. So go to minnesota.devicetalks.com to register for that. Of course, join us on Device Talks Tuesdays. You can go to devicetalks.com to register for those. And if you wouldn't mind, connect with me on LinkedIn if you haven't already. I love making LinkedIn connections. I try to post some good stuff up there. I hope you'll enjoy it. People seem to think it's cool. And while you're on LinkedIn, please connect with our managing editor, Kayleen Brown. She's the best. And of course, the one and only fantastic Chris Newmarker, the creator of the Newmarkers Newsmakers and editor at Mass Device. All right, folks. Thank you again for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. We'll be back next week with another Wham Bang episode. Take care, everybody.